You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. My name is John MacArthur. I am what's known as the team mascot for the Sustainable Development Goals. But also a senior fellow here at Brookings, a senior advisor to the UN Foundation, and partner with the JICA Research Institute. We're here today to talk about a book, Leave No One Behind, and also the ideas around it. This is a project that came together through a longstanding cooperation between Brookings and the JICA Research Institute. We're very grateful to their support and their collaboration in this. Thank you. But it's coming in the context of a broader moment of thinking through what are the Sustainable Development Goals for, what are they meant to achieve, and what do they need to be achieved. Homi and Karas, who is the co-editor here at Brookings with Izumi Ono and myself, we had a conversation almost a couple of years ago where we said, and we're taking stock on the Sustainable Development Goals, there's this through-line pledge, a through-line pledge that the ambassadors who are negotiating the goals said over and over again, especially if one looks back to the final day when the goals were set on Sunday, August the 2nd, 2015, when the negotiators brought to a conclusion 3 years of work to say, what's this all for? And we have one of those negotiators here today, Ambassador Elizabeth Cousins, who is the U.S. lead negotiator. In that final day, the thing that people kept saying over and over again is, we will leave no one behind. Our commitment in taking on these goals, yes, is to tackle the issues of global sustainability. Yes, it's to tackle the issues of global prosperity. But above all, the first among equals is the pledge to leave no one behind. So in thinking about that, we said, as analysts and researchers and sometime practitioners, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to take on a pledge of no one left behind? Who's about to get left behind? And what would it mean to think through what it would do or what it would look like to take it on? As we thought about it and we convened a tremendous roster of authors and analysts, we realized that it came down to specifics. Specific people facing specific problems in specific places. To the extent, I personally have started to think we should be thinking about the SDGs not as the Sustainable Development Goals, but as the Specific Development Goals. Because they are ultimately about people facing problems in the places where they live. So, we decided to take that to heart. And if this will work, can we bring up the screen? We even did some analytics that Homi and I and a former colleague of ours, Krista Rasmussen, who's now based at UN Foundation. We said, well, what would it look like to actually think through who's on track to get left behind? And in that context, we said, well, a lot of these issues are life and death. The Sustainable Development Goals have commitments to get child mortality down to no more than 25 deaths per 1,000 live births in every country by 2030. They have a commitment to get non-communicable disease mortality down by one-third in every country, wherever it started. They have a commitment to cut suicide, homicide, maternal mortality, and traffic deaths. Well, those big pledges, those admirable pledges that presumably each of us would all endorse, those come down to specific people's lives. And as we looked at the math in very basic terms. We said, well, you can actually look at how each country is doing, and if the world and each country keeps going as it's going, then you can see how many people will live or die. What's the difference if we fulfill this commitment or not? So this is, in my view, the starkest form of whether people get left behind or not. It's whether they even get the chance to live. And by our estimation, there are 44 million lives at stake. About 29 million who will die prematurely from non-communicable disease, about 9 million children who will die before their fifth birthday, and more than a million each from suicide, homicide, maternal mortality, and traffic deaths. That's the difference between what the world is doing right now and what it's promised to do by 2030. Those are specific people in specific places facing very specific problems. But the goals, of course, are bigger than that. This is just the people-focused side of it. This isn't meant in any way to diminish the challenges of climate or oceans or biodiversity, but it is meant to focus in on the people dimension of this problem. And when we looked at these broader challenges, if you can see this, these are the number of millions of people whose basic needs are on track to get left behind through our best estimate. Air pollution, there's a commitment to cut air pollution. We said, well, what if we at least interpret that as cut it by half? Well, and the new Director General of the World Health Organization has really taken this on with gusto in the past year. More than 90% of the world is living in mortality-augmenting air pollution. So if that's not cut by half, at least 3.6 billion people will be suffering with that. We looked at inequality in public leadership, gender inequality in public leadership. If you look at the discrimination that's seen in women in office, for example, and you see that as representative of societies writ large, at least 1.9 billion, roughly 2 billion women and girls are being excluded in a crude math from equal opportunity to lead in society. One can go down the list: sanitation, undernourishment, access to electricity, extreme poverty, and so forth. Hundreds of millions of people being left behind. These aren't broad abstractions. These are actual people being left behind. And that's our point. Whether each of these numbers is precisely accurate or not is not the point. The point is that there is some specific number of people that we can identify as being left behind. Now, we didn't want to leave any author behind either. These are all the authors. I think we got all except two, their photos, who are able to contribute, many of whom are here. If you could just raise your hands briefly, some of whom who are here who contributed important chapters, we thank you so much for contributing. But this is just to give a sense of the range of voices and people who brought us to this day for this book. We have topics ranging from gender equality in the first chapter to the second chapter, after the introduction, to challenges of migration, challenges of the ultra-poor, challenges of fragility, challenges of smallholder farmers, challenges of places within countries where people are more likely to be left behind. We have a range of angles that are taken, and even the challenges of politics and of power that need to be confronted in order for these goals to be taken seriously. So with that, I'm delighted that we have an extraordinary panel today that you'll hear from in a moment. We have a person who is, without much argument, something of the godfather of the term Leave No One Behind in the Sustainable Development Goal Agenda, who is Homi Karas, who's our colleague here at Brookings, who chaired the high-level panel on the post-2015 agenda for the Secretary General, which actually crystallized this concept as a driving thought in 2013 and has been carried through ever since. So we couldn't have a better person to moderate this. We have distinguished ministers from Niger and Dominican Republic, and we have the CEO of the UN Foundation, Kathy Calvin, and we're honored that I think as some of you might know, this is Kathy's final tour. She has led the United Nations Foundation with distinction for, depending on exactly how you count it, roughly a decade, and has been there for nearly 15 years overall, helping to lead the way. And Kathy recently announced that she's stepping down and handing it over to her successor, Elizabeth Cousins. So we're honored that they're here today and able to share in this and share their thoughts as we do so. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to our colleague Izumi Ono. Izumi is the director of the JICA Research Institute. She's an accomplished academic and practitioner working on these issues of development, inclusive development, and the social sciences of it for many, many years. She's been an extraordinary collaborator in this project. We're deeply grateful for her practical collaboration as an editor, but also, I would argue, one of the most thoughtful collaborators we've had the chance to work with in recent years, as someone who's clearly dedicated to this, not as an academic exercise, but one that matters for real people. So, Izumi, over to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. And then good morning, everybody. Yeah, with distinguished honorable ministers and guests. My name is Izumi Ono. I just wanted to have a few remarks about this book, and also that because I come from JICA, Japan International Cooperation Agency, which is a development cooperation agency in Japan. So what does this mean for us? And then finally, I wanted to just a few remarks about what I learned by working through this book together with the Brookings Institution. Okay. So I'm very much honored and to be here to share that our book and also messages. And as that John and Homi said, the JICA Research Institute has a long-standing collaboration, research partners with the Brookings Institution over the almost 10 years. So actually that this is the fifth volume of collaboration we have had. I think those, all of them are focusing on the, how we can do for global development solution in a concrete way. So that previous one was from Summit to Solution, which was just came out after the UN adoption of SDG. We wanted to make move from just talking from conferences to actual implementation. Now we wanted to do much further how we can do much more specific action, the which people, what kind of problem, what kind of places are being likely to be being left behind. So this is a volume which we are really working so much, and we are very much grateful for the Brookings Institution and Homies and John. Okay. Let me say just a few words about why we have decided to deal with this topic. Because I think leave no one behind, SDG is such an important end, and then this year is a very much important for the world and also for Japan to take it very much seriously. As you know that the 2019 is a highly important year in the various senses. We just had a G20 Osaka Summit when Japan led the leadership on the presidency in compiling that our communique and the leaders' declaration, which include development issues on the leave no one behind. We also had a Yokohama in Tokyo ticket international conference to discuss Africa, which is a major places where we have to make a major effort to do it. And then we came back from UN-SDG summit. So now we have to really take a concrete actions. This is why that the Leave No One Behind book is a joint effort for major intellectual policy effort aimed at the urging international communities to take specific actions, people, places facing specific problems. I think there are two ways important of this, publication and book. We wanted to move from slogan to implementation. And second of all, I think there are many, many reports and publications and research are done, but I think many of them are either thematic and also are country-focused. But I don't think that the country-focused aggregate data is sufficient. So we have to much more go into detail to really achieve this target of leave no one behind. For example, the UN report, World Bank had Atlas for SDG, and then there are lots of, reports which are talking about that each country is having difficulties, but how can we make it happen in each place? That is a very important thing. Okay. Just a few words about the JICA activities. As a development cooperation agency, we really have position paper how we can achieve better contribute to SDG in three ways. One is we have a core two vision of human security and quality growth. Human security is to protect the most vulnerable people from the diverse shocks and risks and so that they can live in dignity and then freedom from the fear. And also we try to achieve quality of growth in sustainable, resilient, and also inclusive growth. And we wanted to focus on maybe 10 goals directly. At the same time, we wanted to work through partnership to achieve innovation. So we are very much active in various areas, maternal health care, education, disaster bills, infrastructure, various things. At the same time, thinking about leave no one behind, I feel like we try to focus on in the area, 10 area in the left side, but I started to feel like by learning from this research collaboration, we have to do more in the innovative way in working with the various partnerships. So we try to keep better our traditional cooperation approach. At the same time, we have to do more in a new innovative approach. So we have to go beyond the traditional approach to the development cooperation, which includes partnership with cities, partnership with the private sectors, and we have to be very much specific about how we can utilize various information data. So that really require that we have to think about technology issues. So we have to really go beyond traditional approach too. And lastly, I just wanted to mention that maybe future. So we are right now in the 2019, and then we have to keep going because we're the kind of fourth year and the fifth year we are entering. And then toward 2013, for Japanese, I think we have a lot of important benchmarks, like Tokyo Olympics in 2020 next year. And then we're also going to have Expo in Osaka. And then I think we are really discussing how we can contribute as a nationwide and also as our citizens to contribute to the SDG sustainable societies. So I hope discussion today will benefit a lot for us to thinking about to take concrete action. Thank you very much. And then, okay, so I would like to invite the panelists to have a moderate discussion by Homi Karas, and please move ahead. Yes. Okay, yes, please.
Thank you so much, John and Izumi, for kicking us off. My name is Homi Karas. I'm the director of the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. We have a fantastic panel to basically talk about the ideas in this book. John has already started with the introductions, but there were a few quite important pieces that he left out. On my left, he mentioned Kathy Calvin as the president and CEO of the UN Foundation and the many years that she's been in that position. He did not mention that in 2011 she was named one of Newsweek's 150 women who rock the world. Kathy, we're looking forward to seeing a performance from you a little bit later. Before she joined the UN Foundation, Kathy was with AOL, the Time Warner Foundation, and before that at Hill & Knowlton. To her left, we have Minister Juan Ariel Jimenez. He's the Minister of Economy, Planning and Development from the Dominican Republic. As such, he really leads a lot of their work on the reform of health and education policies and in the development sphere. But the thing that really attracted me to from his bio was that he was the co-author of the first Atlas of Economic Complexity. And for many of us working in development, that atlas was a real eye-opener, both in terms of the substantive content, but also in terms of the absolutely fantastic graphical presentations of complexity. So thank you for making complexity a little bit simpler for us to understand. And that's a very important part of the Leave No One Behind problem, because it's a very complex problem that we need to make simple. To his left is Minister Ibrahima Gimba Saidu. Minister Gimba Saidu from Niger is the minister and special advisor and is in charge of the e-government strategy and implementation and the ICT push in Niger. He's also the represents Niger on the steering committee of the Smart Africa Alliance, and his background, as you can imagine, is in ICT and telecoms, and he was in the team of Intelsat before that. And then Izumi Ono, my friend and collaborator from the JICA Research Institute, you've already heard from. So it's a terrific panel, and Kathy, I wanted to start with you, and you know, just start with this idea, which in many ways is a quite a strange idea, that the way to start the process of development in a place like Niger should be in New York, and with these, you know, big UN conferences, we come together, we convene, we establish sustainable development goals, we put out these, you know, these thoughts about, you know, rallying behind, leave no one behind. But why does it start in New York, and what's the value of starting there rather than starting at the bottom? Or is it the case that actually we did start at the bottom and just took it up to New York?
I think the latter is the truth, but it everything must culminate at the UN. So it was the right process. You know, this in 2000, Kofi Annan and maybe two other men in a room created the MDGs. Now, John, I know you're telling the real story of how that all happened, but that is the lore, that the MDGs were a challenging political construct at a time when there was a need for a political construct at the beginning of a new millennium on how we were going to take care of the whole world. And the Millennium Development Goals were a new concept. We hadn't had goals. We hadn't had processes by which countries could be evaluated and held accountable. And over time, over the 15 years of their existence, I think people came to recognize they were successful because they actually led to changes in behavior in countries, not from the top but from the bottom up. So when it came time to look at the fact that they were coming to an end, we realized several things. One was that while we had met the goals globally, and that felt really good in most of the goals, we really hadn't met them in specific places on specific problems affecting specific people's lives, and that was an unacceptable outcome. While we were successful, and as Bill Gates and Bono and many people have said, we made progress that was previously unimaginable, we still hadn't made it for everyone, and so we needed to come to grips with that. So, Homi, I give you credit for recognizing we needed to capture that concept, that we had left people behind, that we weren't reaching the goals if we didn't include everyone, and that those were stubborn places in every single country. So two other recognitions happened, or three, I would say. One was that those goals were about those people over there in countries that needed assistance. And in fact, there was a need for making change and bringing people along in every single country in the world, including this one. So the goals had to be universal this time. And the third recognition was that you can't solve one problem without understanding and thinking about another problem. A girl's education can be deeply affected by her access to health and vice versa. So everything is interrelated, and the only way we would get forward was to take all of them into account, including our planet, which had really been left behind previously. And then finally, it was a recognition that this could not be top-down. It really did require all sectors, civil society, individuals, the private sector. And so we did hear from the world. There was a survey where people said what they wanted and what they needed in their communities and what that they hoped that the world would do to respond to the fact that progress needed to be made in their homes. And so the report you did, I thought, really crystallized for leaders, and that was a multi-sector panel. You had private sector and civil society and government leaders. And it became the basis for a conversation that Elizabeth Cousins and others grappled with, where people brought their different opinions to the table, but they actually traded horses and reached agreement on all of these things. 17 goals, but more importantly, these three really huge concepts. And I think what we are now grappling with as a world, as we are at 4 years and almost 5 years in, is that as long as we think about this at a global level, we cannot make the progress we need to make. It does really require the countries to identify where they need the help, where the people are that are most at need and vulnerable, and define the solutions that really matter. And so I'll just close by saying next 10 years are being defined as the decade of delivery. That is not just the decade of talk or action, but decade of delivery for people and places and problems. And it was just so reassuring to see that the Nobel Prize for Economics recognized three development economists who have been talking about exactly this approach, specific problems in specific interventions in specific places. So I think the world is coming together around a very big idea that started here, came up here, and then was back there.
Thank you, Kathy. And so, you know, let's keep with that thought. And Minister Jimenez, let me turn to you and say, how do you then take these kinds of big ideas and translate them into practice? And Kathy mentioned the idea that in many ways the goals are integrated, so it's an integrated package. Of course, we understand that, but it does introduce a degree of complexity in implementation, because especially for a relatively poor country, it's difficult to do everything at once. Mm-hmm. So you have to choose, people say, where are the priorities? So how do you actually wrestle with that on the ground?
Sure. Well, first of all, I must say congratulations for selecting this topic of leave no one behind. I usually say that averages can be very unfair, because it might lead you to think that everyone is benefiting in the same way and might leave some people unseen in the process. So in terms of the SDGs, the policy process is intrinsically a political process, and a process in which different voices and different interest groups determine the agenda of the country. So the SDGs really help to put on the agenda people, because it's normally about interventions, it's normally about what are we going to do, and not always who is going to be involved. And I really think that the SDGs, in the policy process, we need to think not only how we're going to achieve it, but what particular policies are going to be implemented. And I want to give you an example. In the case of the Dominican Republic, we've had growth experience, a very high growth. From 2004 to 2012, average growth of real GDP was 5.5, which is quite good for a developing country. The only thing is that the real wages were not growing, and therefore the impact on poverty reduction was limited. Whereas after 2012 and since this year, we've had higher growth, but we've seen a very significant increase in real wages. Real wages are growing at 3.2% each year, which has led to a poverty reduction. So we can see the same growth experience having different consequences to people in the same country in a relatively close time period. And that means that the way that we achieve growth is also as important as the growth rate. Before, we were growing in a model in which productivity growth was leading the growth, and that was a productivity basically achieved in urban cities. Whereas now, the priority is given to the rural area, in which we have seen a decrease from 51% of poverty rate in the rural area to 35%. So we're expecting that next year, 29%. So we're expecting that by next year we can achieve 25%. So rural poverty is going to be halved, which is quite good. And how does it, how did we change the policy process? We're bringing different people at the table. Normally we have academics, policymakers, getting in a room and designing policies. So people are left as recipients of the consequences of our decisions, whereas now we're putting people at the center. We're putting people not only as receivers of whatever consequences we have, but also an active party in the process. I want to give you just two examples of how we are translating particular SDGs in that. We have recently released the Territorial Cohesion Fund, which my ministry is leading. So we have selected the 23 communities with highest poverty rates. So we have a fund that we're going to go to the communities, and we are going to invest in the infrastructure that those communities need. So they have to identify the infrastructure, and they have to prioritize the infrastructure because resources are limited. So in that sense, we have seen a very much higher impact of any dollar that we put in the budget. Also, there is another policy that we have implemented, and it was the increase in the loans for the agricultural sector. Before, we used to give loans to big companies working in the rural area, thinking that they could create more jobs, whereas now we're giving it to small farmers, to mutual funds for small farmers that are increasing their capacity to invest in technology, to invest in improved seeds in order to achieve higher productivity. So we have seen policies, you know, including more people when we include them in the discussion. We have this program, it's called Surprise Visit of the President. So he goes every Sunday to a different community, poor communities, and he sits with them and he discusses, what do you want the government to do? And he says, he usually says, I'm not giving you free money. I don't believe in free money. You're going to pay it back, and you're going to pay an interest rate, very low interest rate, but I want to make sure that we invest the money in the things that you decide. So I think that the process of deciding policies are very important in order to not let anyone behind.
That's really interesting. There's a lot there that we'll come back to, but I was particularly intrigued that, you know, in a country which is relatively small in size, I mean, your total land area is not huge, you still have real issues of community differentiation, and that your programs are still oriented around recognizing the differences amongst those communities. Sure. Minister Gimba Saidu, let me turn to you, because, you know, Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world. You were mentioning to me one of the youngest countries, the youngest country in the world. You're faced with this huge array of challenges. And on the one hand, people say to you, you have to do everything. And then on the other hand, people say to you, and you only have this much resources, you have to prioritize. How do you actually take those two completely different pieces of advice and try to reconcile them?
Yes, thank you very much. Maybe a slight correction. I don't think that we're one of the poorest countries. Actually, we're potentially one of the richest. I'll tell you why. And really probably that's the reason why I'm even here, that's the reason why I joined the government. until recently, I think the focus was put on dollar value, on mineral resources. Mm-hmm. And it was really never put on people. And that's why actually earlier I told you, because I think that it's key here. We are the youngest country on earth. Median age in Niger is 15 years old. 2/3 of the population is under 25 years old. So I think potentially we are one of the richest because we believe, I think all of us, that human capital is really the most important resource that we need to have. But I'm emphasizing on the potentially, because now we have quote-unquote role material. All this youth spread across the country, a large country, 1.3, almost 1.3 million square kilometers, and with an extremely low density of population. We're racing actually against time. It's really important for us if we are to ride on this new wave to address all those issues, development issues, more or less at once. So leaving no one behind, I think, really speak to us because we have been left behind for so long. And we came up with an approach which is interesting in really leapfrogging. What we have decided to do is leverage technology to actually catch, you know, the train. Why? We believe that, again, when you take a country like Niger, just maybe to give you a better picture, we're the only country also where you don't have that many people in the cities. The capital city, Niamey, has only 6% of the population. It's unique. Usually in developing countries, you have most of the population in the capital city.
Yeah.
You take the the top 10 cities in the country, they account for less than 15% of the population, really. So it's really quite unique. It's like a blockchain type of thing that we have in Niger. So when you look at it, I mean, on one hand, you see challenges because it's really difficult, almost impossible to create some sort of economy scale if you approaching, you know, the standard way, because it's just too expensive. It's just not sustainable. You cannot maintain the efforts. And then also it's difficult to reach, you know, the right population. So what we have decided to do is to let's come up with a citizen-centric approach and focusing also on service delivery, because at the end of the day, it's about service delivery. How can we enable this youth that we have by really providing to her the necessary ingredient to really transform their communities. Mm-hmm. So for us, really that movement around SDG come like at the right point. We actually set up a process which I call carpooling for development because what we're trying to do is we have to address all this at once. We cannot focus on just one element. And why carpooling? Because that's how we're going to create the economy of scale. Mm. And we bring all the stakeholders, government, private, public sector, development partners, and ask them to ride with us on that development, you know, bus into each and every village of Niger. We launch a program called Smart Village. So now you understand why, because we're mostly in rural areas. And Smart Village is the program through which we connect the unconnected. Mm. But we connect by the unconnected by bringing services to the unconnected. So we build information highways, so we don't have physical roads. We have a digital roads into each and every village. And what we do when we drop a connection in a village, we bring we bundle it with healthcare, with education, because also what we're focusing on is really knowledge acquisition. We believe that if those fresh brains are exposed to knowledge, to information, then we'll really be able to bank on the demographic, a dividend. Mm. And be able actually in those remote areas to really bring transformation. Because people will have access to healthcare, to education, to also information, because most of them are farmers or shippers. So really, real information on farming, so that they can increase, you know, the production productivity in the villages, and then be linked also at the same time to the rest of the world. So that's what we have set up in Niger, and addressing really all those issues, whether it's gender, whether it's poverty. I even like to say that we have a comparative advantage because all those, we're living them really firsthand. So instead of seeing it as a problem, let's turn it into an opportunity. And then that's why and where also technology is important. I even call it like a fertilizer, because if we're able to really use the beauty of technology to provide all those access to all those services which otherwise won't be possible, then we will be able to transform the country into one of the potentially rich countries. So I'm probably going to stop here for now.
Well, thank you. I mean, that is really inspiring. And I love your analogy of the carpooling to development. But let me push you a little bit and say, you mentioned in that carpool that you've also got development partners.
Yes.
What do all of the donor countries, these people who are trying to help you, mm-hmm. how do they feel about Leave No One Behind and about what you're trying to do? Are they fully on board? Have you had problems in corralling them into this vision, mm-hmm. Which might be a bit different from the, let's say, the traditional way that they've thought about development?
Yes. I mean, I've been in office for slightly over 2 years. It hasn't been an easy ride. It was bumpy at times with some of the partners because they, unfortunately, some had already ideas on how to implement things in our countries. Mm-hmm. So they just want us to say yes. Mm-hmm. You know, they know it all. And then we just have to...
That's called country ownership in this town.
So we had to push back. So with some, it was really brutal even. But with many, fortunately, I think they were maybe hoping that in a country like Niger, actually they will have this type of conversation. Mm. So the UN is one of them. I even signed an LOI with the UN agencies. And actually, I don't know if you know it, but the UN Foundation is part of a pilot that we're running in the country. So the UN has really fully embarked in this approach, and then some other development agencies, because we told them exactly what we wanted. Mm-hmm. There were even few that I had to ask to quietly leave my office, because I mean we didn't. They need to accept mm-hmm. that we have to work as a team,
yeah.
And also they need to accept that there is. Maybe a bit of homework that we need to do together. Mm-hmm. You know, because the most important thing is also, even for me, is really to go in the villages and to ask people what they really want. I don't know it. And that's what we have been doing. So now, after 2 years, I'll say most of the development partners are on board. Last July, because Niger has hosted the African Head of State meeting, organize an integration lab, and it was really well attended by most of the partners. So now we have the ball rolling. There is funding coming, but I mean, I'm throwing certain things down because we need to really make sure that we control that, that we work as a team. We still have some donors who have their own agenda, who still want to, because they have money, they would just want to impose their views. So we're struggling a bit of with some of those. But most of them now, I can say, understand that it makes sense really to work together. It makes sense also to complement each other, because each of the topics, you take agriculture, I mean, you can have 100 programs that's in agriculture. Mm-hmm. So we We had to work to show them that they all can still achieve their agenda while working as a team. You know?
That's great. Izumi, let me turn to you. And I saw on one of the slides that you put up that you know, Japan had hosted the G20, is still the G20 chair for this year. And I know that Japan actually made a big effort, in part thanks to you and you know, your leadership on this, to include the SDGs as a topic for the G20.
Yes.
And so we've sort of seen this idea move from the UN to other kinds of clubs and groups who see it as something that they could also promote. Tell us a little bit about, you know, why is this important for Japan, and why do they take these kinds of ideas and try to push it through a, you know, a group, the G20, which is actually largely about how the world economy should proceed, rather than about the poorest people, let's say, in the world economy.
Yeah, I think there are two issues. One is, I think for Japan itself, I think leaving no one behind is a very important, I think, also political messages. Mm-hmm. I think our problem is different from the problem with a developing country. I will touch upon that. But I think for Japan, also, we are really facing a new sort of challenges. Like, we are aging population. Our population is young people is decreasing. How to revitalize the local cities, for example. So it's a big challenge. And then for us, to leave no one behind is a nice way to how to reorganize our thinking in the policy issues. So I think Japanese government also took that opportunity to really, we have to take a leadership, and also for the world, at the same time, there are lots of important meaning for remaining issues which we have to tackle. And then many civil society has responded strongly. So that is one thing. The other is, I think we have, we have been working for many, many years for development cooperation, and we feel like there are many issues which we can share globally through the accumulated experiences. And then, and also, I think that the G20 and also maybe we are also coming to the Tokyo Olympics. And then those are very important benchmarks for us to really link what we have been doing through international cooperation with that kind of the global challenges to make the people aware of this. So what we did in like a T20 process and also G20 process, but we really put together with that civil society, research think tanks, and we really brought together a lot of academia from globally, including you. And then one of the, I think, important messages that we try to work hard by linking with that kind of business people. And also we have to really jointly take action contributing to those global challenges. One thing I wanted to mention is that it's interesting things happening in Japan and also in local area, particularly in the western part of Japan, because they organized G20 summit in Osaka, and also they're going to host maybe in 2025 the expo also. And for them, how to revitalize their economies by utilizing their knowledge and technologies, and also by linking with, I think, global challenges is very important. So in the western part of Japan, there are very quite active partnership going on in western kind of the 7 or 8 the prefectures. And JICA is collaborating with the civil society and business people, and also that the local government of organizing the Kansai, that the western part of kind of that the SDG platform. And that really funded the basis for G20 discussion, and also that future the SDG platform. So this is what's happening right now.
Thank you. Let me do one more. There's one more thing I really wanted to go to the panel. Then I'm going to open it up to Q&A from the audience. But Kathy, you started to mention it, and Minister Jimenez as well, this whole idea of voice and agency. And we have in the book a chapter, a little bit of a provocative chapter, but the title is something about whether people are being left behind or whether people are being pushed behind. Mm. And so it's really a question about, ultimately, about power, voice, and agency. And you brought that up at the beginning in your comments. Do you want to say a little bit more about that and how we should think about that, especially here? Yeah. It seems to be something quite that's actually now moving from something that people would talk about, perhaps, but not necessarily act on, to actually starting to be a little bit more ingrained in many of the conversations we're having.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in movements across the board, from young people on climate to Me Too, you name it, there's a very strong view of nothing about us without us that has to be brought into this conversation. And, you know, what both of you talked about listening to your citizens and really empowering them, I think is such a big challenge, you know, because so often development, country-owned means so many different things, but it doesn't have the people at the table mm-hmm. who have the greatest knowledge of what's needed and also will have very important views about what priorities are and how much they're willing to do themselves and pay. So we just have to make sure that the process is leaving no voices behind as well. And I think it's related to two other issues that I would say probably have to be thought about in every country. One is the source of data. Mm. Is it good enough? Is it too disaggregated that we really don't know enough about women? We just know in general. Is it old and cold, which is typically the case with statistical data from countries because it's just expensive to collect it? How do we better use big data? So I think one of the exciting things that also came out of your report was a data revolution report that followed, and how we think about improving the data we collect and the data we act on and the data we measure is essential to getting those voices heard, because the data is only about people at the end of the day. And the other is who is holding governments, two great governments, but who, not every government is great, but who's really holding them accountable? Is it your civil society, and are they fully empowered, those people? Is it journalists, and are we training our journalists to be good at reminding people what was agreed to in New York or agreed to in Capitol or in community, and how are we fulfilling it? And I can't say enough about how this median age is really going to be a part of the challenge and the solution as we get through this decade of delivery. I mean, the U.S. and Germany are at median age 36 and 38, respectively. Here you are at 15. Yemen is, I think, 16. Uganda's maybe 17. I mean, it's a world of difference. And we are looking at the biggest populations also where the biggest poverty still is. So we've just got to find a better way. But I think young people are going to demand it, and the tools are there now also because of technology. But I'm curious how you guys are helping that.
Mr. Jimenez, I mean, I was so fascinated by this concept of the surprise visits. I mean, that seems such a... So how did that come about? Whose idea was it? And tell us about how, you know, has it been... You seem to suggest it's been effective, but can you give us some examples about... Literally, what changes, what kinds of changes have happened as a result?
Sure, yeah. I can give you a practical example, not from surprise visit of the president, but one of my visits to the communities. So I went to the second poorest province in the country, which is called Pedernales, near Haiti. So when we went there and we talked to people, first thing they said was, we don't need more training. We've been trained to do candles. We've been trained to do this and that and that. We need clients, not training. Whatever client you have, we will know how to make it. So bring us clients. So that changes all the priors that we had relative to what we thought it was needed. I remember going to this other community and talking to them. And after that, I realized, you know, none of my training and my readings and that helped me in here. I don't know much more than them. I should be a facilitator of their own process and not the leader of the process, because they know what they need, they know how to do it, They just need resources and coordination. So going back to your question about surprise visit, it was the president's idea. So let me just tell you something about Dominican politics. So the current president, he lost the election in 2006. He lost the primary. So he dedicated his time to go around the country and talk to people, of course, building his platform. And he realized that all the things he thought about of those communities when he was prime minister were not true. So he realized that talking to people, listening to them, is the best way to have the knowledge in order to design appropriate policies. So that's why he came up with a surprise visit. He goes every Sunday to different communities. He meets with all the leaders of the community, and they discuss two things. First of all, infrastructure, what they need. Sometimes it's very small infrastructure with not a lot of money, but very high impact. And also what kind of loans they need in order to increase their productivity. Is it a factory? Is it a genetically modified seed? Is it this or that? And after they decide, the president's office gives the loan. So I think in order to leave no one behind, and I want to get back to you, Kathy, I think that we shouldn't leave anyone unseen. And we need to invest in data. Data collection is costly, but that is the only way in which we can realize that there are some things that we don't get if we just look at averages, if we look at numbers for the entire country. So we have to invest more in data in order to be able to see them. The second thing would be leave no one unheard. The way we design the policy process has an impact in which kind of policies we end up deciding. So it's, I think those two things are very important, seeing people through the data and listening to people through the policy process.
Thank you. So on data and technology, Mr. Gimba Saidu, I mean, what you described about dropping essentially a digital highway into every village actually creates opportunities for a completely different type of data collection information. In the book, we make some use of satellite imagery as a way of getting more immediate real-time data and perhaps more objective data than sometimes comes out of government statistical offices. But how do you sort of view that process as giving more voice and identity to basically the people in these rural areas, which I presume must have been quite difficult to be seen, be heard, etc., without that?
So definitely a country like Niger lacks of data, right? So that's why I think many projects actually were just developed based on wrong information even. So this program which I mentioned, the Smart Village Program, is about connecting about 15,000 villages. Wow. And so that will give us the opportunity to collect an immense amount of data. And behind what we're doing, we have already started it, is to build a platform with the youth. So we have really very good programmers, data scientists, which we're bringing together to collect those data and then to be able now to guide us to interpret those data in the various and different way. That's one. Two, from the very beginning, we want to be really specific. Each village is unique. And it's more or less like a franchise approach that we're having. Because in each village, basically what we're doing, we're organizing the community. It's really the community leaders. So usually you have a group of, because women have their own, we call them cooperatives. I don't know what the name is in English, but I mean they have their group. So we use them. But we also have what I call the help desk of the village, which is a group formed by the youth and we already start using having the gender equality because we want to have the same. It's a group of four, so two female and then two male young people, which we train, and who are actually really the help desk in the village. We go through them because we have literacy challenges, so they're the one helping those who are not literate, because technology is also about really inclusiveness. So how can we make sure that people speak digital? And then also, they are the one making sure that we're implementing what the community has requested. Mm-hmm. As you maybe mentioned earlier, there are so many things to do that we need to find a balance between being specific, but yet making sure that all the fundamentals are in place. And that's, so we're using a combination of pooling data from the villages, having people on the ground telling us what to do, and monitoring all those. And it's really exciting because it's something that has never been done before. So the only thing that we're convinced of is that it's going to work. We just need to make sure that people are empowered and that people have access to knowledge. That's why we're focusing on the knowledge. What we want to avoid is to tell people what to do or to tell them, you know, they need more of this or that. We don't want to do it at all. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a good example. I was born in one of the remote places of Niger. Mm-hmm. And I'm where I am today because I've been exposed to knowledge. No one has told me what to do. I wanted to be an astronaut. Yes. Really, that was my dream. I mean, I end up being in satellites. Maybe
it could still
enough,
come
but
true.
No, but no one told me. So imagine, I mean, a young kid from Niger in this type of environment, you know, thinking that he can become an astronaut. That's the type of, I mean, dream that we want to entertain. So if we give people, again, access to knowledge and based on their specific requirements, you know, addressing, we need to address the immediate needs. Like, we cannot compromise on healthcare, on education, and some of the fundamental, like ID, making sure that people, because we need to identify people to be able to. So those are the fundamentals that we need to put in place. But the rest, we have to leave it up to the community and then support them. And then collection of data through those link, because the platform that we're deploying, I mean, it's a combination of satellites, fiber, microwave. So whatever technology can help us pull data, actually, we use.
So Kathy mentioned that most data is old and cold. So now for you, you know, as you think about fine-tuning programs, et cetera, what are we talking about in terms of data? Are you basing it on data that is 1 year old, 6 months old? Is it more of a interactive kind of thing? I mean, just give a quick sense of the change.
So for now, I mean, we have to. For now, it's really interactive because we go in the community, we collect data because there wasn't anything before, and most of the data that I have seen are really wrong data because what were happening? I mean, they. They're either too old because the country, again, is really vast. And then we don't have roads. Most of the country is in the desert. I can guarantee you that there are some places that if you travel to those places once, you don't want to go back. Because it's just, it's tough going there. So most of the data that comes from those areas are not even worth using. So we prefer to go, at least at the beginning, let's say, completely virgin territory, and then, as I say, start by bringing the fundamentals, connecting the clinic, because they don't have doctors, so we do telemedicine. We bring a local server in the village with some free information, like Wikipedia, Khan Academy, on a local server, a Raspberry Pi server, and then have a free Wi-Fi in the village that people can access. Again, it's about making sure that they have free access to knowledge. So that helps us, you know, put the fundamentals. And then we have a community center where we talk to the various groups. So if it's farmers, we train them, we talk specific about them, with them. We share information on weather, on seed, I mean, the basic data they need. So that's what we're doing for now, and then collecting the data. Probably in 2-3 years, we'll have enough data now to start really planning accordingly and then try to anticipate some of the programs.
Sounds like a fantastic foundation. Let me open up to the audience for Q&A. We have about 15 minutes plus left. Microphones will come round. If you can just identify yourself, please, and ask a question, please.
Sure. My name is Anthony Siciliano. I'm with the Center for Global Health and Development. Thank you for the panel. It's a great discussion. And I just wanted to ask, one of the strategic partners that I've noticed wasn't really discussed were investors. There currently is expected to be a $3 trillion funding gap to make the development goals, quote-unquote, sustainable. And, for example, we recently held an event at UNGA, which brought together not only ministers of health, ministers of finance, but also private sector corporations and the heads of private equity and venture capital investors. And let me just give you a quick example. Decentralization of healthcare. That is a great driver to not leave people behind. It brings the services to remote areas. It, through connectivity, will allow almost rapid testing, rapid diagnosis. The concept is wonderful, but private sector investors who actually can have the funding to make these things scalable and replicable are only now being brought into the process. And had they been engaged earlier on, the model would have fit, and our organization, what we're doing now, is bringing the investors in to work in the context, to get these funded, to make them truly sustainable. Because in light of the funding gaps, the difficulty in raising enough donor capital, the capital markets are really where we're relying upon. So my question to you as a panel is, our approach in terms of engaging investors, is that something that you as a panel seeing as indispensable to, quote, not leave anyone behind? And if so, what steps do you see as necessary to engage the investors, the private sector, that don't necessarily speak our language of health? I come from a health background. I practice law. I don't know a lot about finance. I've gotten to know a lot about finance, but they speak in a completely different language than health professionals do. So do you see that as important? And if so, how do you see the necessary next steps to make these truly sustainable? Thank you.
Thank you. Let me take a few, and then I'll come to the panel. There's a lady in the back.
Is this working? Yes, it is now. Okay.
Nope, not anymore.
I'm Caroline from Processus. I have a question largely for
Minister Jimenez. So,
you are destroying the microphone.
And right here, please. Do we have something working?
I don't think I need a mic.
Yeah, there are people behind as well.
Okay. I'm Ed Allendorf from the UN Association and Partnership for Transparency, formerly the World Bank. I want to push further on the issue of specifics and how we get to specifics, because I sense, and this is where I challenge all of you, that state-driven, from above, services will not reach those who are left behind. I'd like to hear more about how the civil society can, in fact, be engaged? What can be done to encourage the formation of more civil society organizations? What can be done further to acknowledge the accountability of the public authorities to the civil society? It seems to me this kind of shift will leave fewer people behind at a time when governments around the world seem to be closing in and reducing the space for civil society. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we start with those, and then I'll come back for another round from the audience. Minister Jimenez, there was a question specifically to you.
Yeah, sure. I might want to connect it to the first question. So I would say we have to distinguish between investors that create jobs, and that is the main focus, and job creation is one of the main drivers of poverty reduction. So we have to include investors in the process because we have to put in place the needed infrastructure and public services that they need in order to invest. And through their investment, they can create the jobs that we need. That is different to having investors do public services, which creates a challenge for the government that we need to improve our ability to regulate and our ability to monitor their practices. Oftentimes, governments are somehow experienced in service provision and in supporting other participants in the process. But regulation and having to decide who does what and the consequences of bad actions is quite a big challenge, especially in developing countries that are very relational. Because, you know, relations are formed and any decision that you make affect one other network that you have to take into account. So I would go to the second question. But colonialism, honestly, no. We have a lot of FDI. We are the second country receiving the highest FDI numbers in Central America and the Caribbean after Panama. And what we have seen is that multinationals, you know, they have their interests. We have to admit that they are profit-driven, and they look after being having the highest profit possible, which is acceptable, as long as they respect our laws and they respect our procedures and all that. So, you know, it's a normal process of defining the limits of actions. But we've seen job creation, we have seen productivity growth and linkages to small firms, so that's good. In terms of other donors, let's say multilateral agencies and other countries, I relate a lot to my colleague minister, what he was saying, that sometimes they have their own agenda. They know what they want to do, and they want to impose the agenda on the policy process. And I've had the same experience. I say, you know, if that is your priority, probably you can see other countries that would prioritize that, but not in our country. So if you want to work with me, this is my agenda, and you cannot change it. We can discuss it, but you cannot impose any topic that it does not respond to our basic needs. Regarding the civil society, I'm working a lot on that. So one of the areas in which I put in a lot of emphasis is in transparency, because I think that when we give to the population the information that they need, they are able to interact in a different way, and they have power. So I am putting in the webpage all the public investment that we're doing. So it's called the investment map. So people can see where the government is investing, who is the contractor, what's the execution in terms of physical and financial execution, and the details of the contract. And in that way, they can participate in the local process. They can say, you know, the government has given you all this amount and you haven't started. Why is it? We're also putting in the webpage all the information about NGOs. So many NGOs in our country, they receive public money from the government. So we're putting that in a webpage that is user friendly, And in that way, people can know, well, the government is giving all this money to this NGO, and they are not providing me the service that they are, that they say they should provide. So by giving data, by giving information, I think we give power. And we change the discussion inside the community and in the nation as a whole. And let me just finish. I've talked too much. We're also being transparent on what level we should have in terms of both SDGs and our national development strategy, where we are, and the policies that each ministry say they are going to implement in order to achieve the goals and reduce the gap. In that way, I'm looking that people can have a different way to participate in the discussion. They can say, you know, doing those policies, you're not going to reduce the child mortality. Or if you're prioritizing that policy, I don't see that in the budget. So I think that improved the discussion, and at the end, it ends up improving the policy process.
Yeah. Can I just...
Thank you.
Yeah. Just
to, Izumi?
Yeah, yeah. Regarding the private sector's role, yeah, I think it's a very, very important issue. Actually, we have discussed a lot with the G20 and the SYNC20 process. And I guess, despite a lot of potential of the important role of private sectors, I think they are quite aware of the sustainable development goal. At the same time, I think in reality, for various reasons, it's still hard for many of the corporates to integrate that concept into real business strategies. Mm-hmm. So how we are going to do it? I think that we have a good chapter by the Professor John Nelson and that some of the private sectors activity, like including MARS and the NESE, how that the smallholders, agriculture holders, can be linked with the big business. And they have the kind of better quality, the training, and then the marketing. So how that, I mean, that the business coalition integrating smallholders become a very good thing. So I think it's an important thing that we have to really advertise and then share those good practices much more globally and then incentivize all the kind of those potentially interesting business leaders to take on that. At the same time, I think there are a lot of I think ESG investment is now picking up. But I think we should do more, I think, incentivization so that they can, maybe many of the ESG is still climate finance. So how are we going to turn that into much more human-centered, I think, investment? I think that is very, very important thing. So this is what I just wanted to say. Yeah.
Great. I think we have time for one last question. Who's going to be the brave soul? All right, we'll do two. Two brave souls.
Hi, my name is Griffin Saul. I'm a fall intern for UNA USA at the UNF. My question specifically is for Minister Ibrahima, but I would love for everyone to answer as well. You mentioned that Niger is working to build human capital, and in some cases you guys might be the richest country as a result of that. As a young person, that very much resonated with me because I believe in young people's ability to catalyze change. I'm curious what Niger is doing to build social capital, though, because we know so much of social change revolves around building relationships and harnessing the power of people. So is that taken into consideration when you're visiting communities and connecting villages? And if not, what steps can you do to move forward with that?
Thank you. Behind you.
Hello. My name is Dianire. I'm leading an international network. I'm working for women entrepreneurs in the Americas region, very focused on Hispanic women. And so I have basically two questions. So one is...
One.
Okay, one question. So basically is, so what I see in the country, at the country level, is first that there is still a need of mentoring, training, and a lot of non-financial services. But the question is, who is leading... who has the ultimate responsibility to coordinate that at the country level? Because as a nonprofit, I think that we feel lonely in this. We feel that we're providing a lot of services and we don't get the support from financial, multilaterals, and also private sector and public sector. So we feel totally lonely in this work on promoting sustainability, the SDG.
Thank you.
I'll take a quick answer for some of that. You know, so I think one of the challenges is that we see in every government, work is done in silos, and I think the silos are going to have to change. Many of you know Gita Raghupta, who was for many years here with the ICRW, then went to UNICEF, and she's now working on a project to show that you can't get to the gender solutions, to take one, without really making sure you're breaking down the silos between the health minister and the energy minister and the women's minister, if there is one. And so I think that's got to be part of the solution that comes in this regard, so we take care of that. I think the other silo is the new investor movement needs to connect with the philanthropic, and we need blended finance because mm-hmm. the solutions and the money just aren't at the same scale yet, and so it's not connecting properly for the size solutions that people need. And so money may go into the wrong places, or we may be judging the wrong thing. So I think that's another piece of the challenge that will have to be addressed.
Mr.
Yeah, thank you. So maybe it's one of the things that we're doing in Niger. Like my department actually is doing exactly that. I coordinate all the government efforts. That's why even maybe I was talking about carpooling. Mm-hmm. I'm the one driving the bus, so to speak. So that's really what we do. I'm the facilitator. I talk to the Minister of Health, the Ministry of Education, and then I try to aggregate all the needs and then put, common platform. And I also do talk to NGOs and then to the different players in doing that. And what we, maybe there are a few things that we're doing also. I set up clusters where you're talking about civil society. Actually, they are invited into those clusters. For example, in agriculture, under the leadership of the Minister of Agriculture, we bring the NGOs, we bring the development partners, the civil society, the youth, because that's really the entrepreneurs, to discuss and then set the priorities and start implementing things. So we do it in right now in 5-6 clusters: health, education, environment, and local content development and things like that. So we're going to have a few more. And there is even a place that I set up. It's like an innovation place that we're setting up, so where this conversation is taking place. The other thing also maybe regarding civil society, we're the first country to have signed the Mountain Table agreement. So in Niger, so journalists actually can really speak freely. They don't go to jail, and then they're really bringing all they need to bring, to the surface, so that we're held accountable. Few other things that we're doing, maybe specifically for the youth, we have been organizing for the past 29 months a monthly boot camp on technology. So what we do during those boot camp every month, we pick a topic. It can be maybe technology for people living with disabilities, or technology with religion, technology with health, technology empowering women. So every month there is a specific topic where we bring, again, civil society and then the youth. We discuss that topic and see how we can. Remember, I said that we're really using technology to address, the key development issues. So we're having that conversation. We're using that boot camp to train people. So schools actually send us students, which we train during the day. And then at the end of the day, we have two or three programs that we continue running. We have set up a specific track for kids 15 and under that we train. We initiate to coding, etc. I have initiated a program, volunteer program, that so next year, next summer, we intend to send youngsters actually in villages, so they will go spend a month or two in those villages actually contributing to those, so training the youth that is in the village and also helping the communities. So that's what we're trying to do, really, to get the population involved, so the youth. I'm the only department actually, I accept all internships. I have more interns than staff. Yes. And I'm doing it on purpose because I believe with what we're trying to do, I want to get the population involved. I want them to take ownership of what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And the best way of doing it is to inviting them. My office, sometime I'm there even until midnight. I don't have hours. You go Sunday, there are people there because I have organized some space where they have good internet connection. I put resources at their disposal. The only thing is they need to tell me what they're working on so that, you know, we can build on their findings and try to do things. So we're trying, really different things to see what works. Mm-hmm. And then because you have, you want to make sure that everybody is involved, you cannot also be too specific. So if there is a group of youngsters who want to work on a specific thing, the only thing that they want to know is how it relates to the big picture and then how they are going to also be accountable. Mm-hmm. And then try to work with them on that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, we've reached the end of our time. Please join me in thanking our wonderful, wonderful... Kathy, you know, I don't know how many more times we will have the pleasure of seeing you up on this stage. We certainly hope we will, but in your current capacity, this may be one of the last times, and so we really wanted to just say thank you so much for everything you've done, not just today, but over the years. So thank you.
It's been an honor, and I know without me there... There'll be room for many more of you to carry that torch forward. So go on to it. Thank you very much.